In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Popular understanding of the Holocaust in all its horror and complexity is often incomplete or fractured. That's the view of historian Dan Stone, whose new book, The Holocaust: An Unfinished History, sets out to deepen our view of the Holocaust's true nature, from the scope of international collaboration to the fallacy of industrial murder. He spoke to Matt Elton.
Dan, I wanted to start talking about your new book about the Holocaust and say that to me, one of the things that stood out about it was, and I hope I'm using the right sort of language here, that it sort of engages with some of the messiness of the topic, the ways in which the topic kind of spills over the boundaries of how we often understand it. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Yes. Thank you, actually. I think that's an interesting observation because it runs counter, I think, to what historians are trained to do on the whole, which is to try and bring some order to the events of the past, which are often appear real life is messy, right? So doing historical research often reflects that messiness, and historians tend to impose order on the things that they study and turn them into a narrative or an analysis which makes sense of a particular set of sources and problems and research questions. But when you come to deal with an event like the Holocaust, which is not just brutal and violent and traumatic, but continent-wide, transcontinental in its implications, a major part of modern world history, the mess and the chaos are very difficult to tame. And I think historians have the feeling that trying to tame them is in some ways inappropriate as well, not just because of the scale of the event, but also because, irrespective of how large the scholarship has become, there's always a sense, I think, that historians are grappling with, that something exceeds our ability to understand in this instance. There's always something that, as you say, kind of spills over and that doesn't really make sense to us, no matter what frameworks we try to use to make sense of the past. So, yeah, I think that's a really good observation.
And you identify, I think, four sort of threads that run their way through the book, and we'll probably touch on some of them as we go. I wanted to start, though, by getting your take, going back to the origins of the story, I suppose, on what you think the key factors were in the emergence of Nazism, and whether you think it's important to see them in terms of a wider picture than just being based in Germany.
I certainly think that, the latter, that looking to Germany alone is not sufficient. What I think Nazism represents, on the whole, is an extreme manifestation of phenomena that are fairly common across Europe and beyond in the interwar period. So one of the things I wanted to stress in the book is that Nazism doesn't come from nowhere, and I think this is a problem in the way that Nazism and the Holocaust are taught at schools and to some extent at universities, that they're students are confronted with what appears to be a kind of alien life form that's suddenly dumped on this planet, and all these strange people with their strange beliefs living in Germany in the interwar years, and then who then come to power in 1933. Now, actually, when you look at the rise of Nazism, it is more extreme. But first of all, it is a variety of fascism, in my opinion. Hitler is very much influenced by Italian fascism. Mussolini, until the Third Reich becomes more significant and more powerful, Mussolini is a kind of older brother to Hitler and to someone that he looks up to. The importance of the First World War in the rise of fascism obviously can't be overstated. The Bolshevik Revolution, the rise of communism across Europe, the chaos of the interwar years after World War I, the continued fighting, the various civil wars, population exchanges, the rise of the notion of statelessness, the rise of concentration camps, refugee camps, all of these are phenomena that fuel the rise of Nazism. And most important of all is the Great Depression, because there, up until that point, Nazism remains more or less a fringe movement in Germany. And so it's the Great Depression that gives the Nazis the push that brings them into power. And that, of course, is a worldwide phenomenon. The response in Germany is different, but only, again, in quantity, not in quality, I think, from what's happening elsewhere. But it's certainly part of a much broader European and worldwide phenomenon.
And so what happens in Germany is a reaction to, is a specific reaction, but a reaction nonetheless to a whole set of wider international factors. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. It still leaves the problem, however. I mean, it begs the question, in a sense, for why does Nazism happen in Germany and not elsewhere? And that is harder, I think, to explain, because no matter what we look at, and I often, with my students, often say, well, let's look at the question of eugenics, say. It's, first of all, a movement that didn't begin in Germany. It's most notably taken up in the US and in Britain, at least intellectually, not in terms of legislation. It's important in Scandinavia, in many colonial settings, and in Latin America, and so on. But in Germany, eugenics, therefore, is not something unique to Germany, but it's only under the Nazis that eugenic policies are made into the heart of what the regime does and the way it thinks. And that distinguishes the Third Reich under the Nazis from other regimes, whether authoritarian or fascist or liberal democratic, where eugenics is concerned, at least until World War II. And the same is true in every other respect, that we can say that Nazism is related to fascism, that it draws on the same international crises that have brought about all sorts of changes in the interwar period elsewhere in Europe. Nevertheless, this specifically German aspect of it isn't really addressed by saying so.
I wondered if we could talk a bit about how we should properly understand the relationship between Nazism and anti-Semitism and fascism. Mm-hmm. How do you think we should understand the ways in which those are related but different to each other, perhaps?
That's a really important question, a big question. I mean, I think one of the myths about Italian fascism is that the race laws in 1938 were introduced because of the rising power of the Third Reich and as a way to kind of assert Italy's own sovereignty vis-a-vis Nazi Germany, and that there was no real anti-Semitism in Italian fascism before that point. And actually that idea has been, to a large extent, scotched, I think, by recent historiography. Nevertheless, it remains the case that in the 1920s, there were many Jews who were members of the fascist party in Italy, and fascism wasn't unreservedly anti-Semitic in the way that Nazism was. That's a bit different from, I think, fascist movements elsewhere. If you look at the rise of the Ustasha in Croatia, or the Iron Guard in Romania, or the Vichy regime in France, you see that anti-Semitism is very much built into the way they think. The difference with Nazism is that for the leading Nazis, anyway, for Hitler and Himmler and Heydrich and Eichmann and that leadership stratum, for Goebbels, their obsession with Jews, or with the Jew, the international Jew, lies behind everything that they do and think. So they see everything in the world related to this problem of the Jew. And I think for leaders allied to Nazi Germany, let's say Ion Antonescu in Romania or Admiral Horthy in Hungary, they are, of course, deeply anti-Semitic. Antonescu comes quite close to holding a kind of paranoid conspiracy theory view to Hitler's, but in the end, none of them are quite as totally obsessed with the Jew as Hitler is. And so for Hitler and the leading Nazis, I think what Saul Friedlander calls redemptive anti-Semitism is a powerful idea. That's to say, they believe that history is driven by this clash between Aryan and non-Aryan, between German and Jew, i.e. between good and evil, and that in order that Germany should be redeemed, the Jew has to be defeated. Whereas I think for Hitler's allies, they're slightly more pragmatic. They throw their lot in with the final solution, certainly because they're anti-Semitic, but that anti-Semitism is more about creating ethnically homogeneous nation states, whether in Romania or Hungary or Slovakia or where it is, rather than this notion of fighting a world historical enemy. So for Hitler and the Nazis, there's something metaphysical about their anti-Semitism, whereas I think for those allied to Nazi Germany, it's a kind of practical question, obviously based also on false beliefs about Jews, but nevertheless, it's more a kind of practical question. Once the Jews are expelled from country X, then they're not really very interested anymore.
One of the things that struck me most about your book is how international this story really is. What are some of the key ways that you think that we have in the past perhaps not given enough emphasis to about that international story?
That's a really good question. I think, first of all, this is understandable in a way when we think historically about the ways in which the scholarship has developed. The emphasis was on Germany. And obviously that's because most Holocaust historiography from the end of the war onwards was based on the records captured and presented at Nuremberg in the first international military tribunal. And those documents, which are primarily German perpetrator documents, have formed the backbone of Holocaust historiography ever since, although now supplemented with a vast range of other sources. And I think that produced a picture which suggested that most Holocaust victims were German Jews. I think, inevitable if you write a book about the Holocaust, and mine is no different, that you start with the persecution of the Jews in Germany in the years 1933 to 38, 39. And it gives the impression that the Jews of Germany were the main victims of the Holocaust, whereas in fact, they, as I tried to show in the book, they make up no more than a couple of percent of the victims of the Holocaust. And that's something that I think is very surprising to people, because we still think of people like Anne Frank as representative victims of the Holocaust, and she was not. And so that's the first thing that we need to think about, that the victims of the Holocaust were from a much wider range of places than we tend automatically to assume. But nevertheless, the majority were Orthodox, traditional, poor Jews living in what had formerly been the Pale of Settlement in the Russian Empire, so the borderlands of Eastern Europe, what's today, well, the borderlands of Poland, the Baltic states, Belarus, and Ukraine. That's where the majority of the Holocaust victims were from, and where most of them were killed as well. So it's quite a different picture from the one that we see when thinking about the German Jews. The other issue, I think, and this is something that is much more recent in terms of the development of the historiography, that we see that the Holocaust was actually a worldwide phenomenon. And there's been much greater appreciation of this recently, that there was a lot of transoceanic migration involved, Jews trying to escape, whether via Marseille or later via Lisbon, the last port where Jews could get out of Europe before and even after the war had started, that Jews made their way anywhere they could get visas to. Large numbers of Jews in Shanghai, in Japanese-occupied Manchuria, in the Philippines, in Bolivia, in the Dominican Republic, in Mauritius, etc., etc. So this is a story in world history, and the movement of ships and of refugees and of particularly of Jewish refugees makes this into a much bigger history than one confines either to Germany or to Europe as a whole.
And that sense of migration, the kind of constant movement, I think you call it, caused a form of trauma beyond the sort of the trauma that we obviously quite often focus on. Is that right?
I mean, I think, first of all, that when I talk about the trauma of the Holocaust, I don't necessarily mean in a strictly clinical sense, in the sense that comes from, is synonymous with PTSD and so on. Although I am suspicious of the way in which the term trauma has been used in it broadly in our culture to mean, you know, anything bad. But I do mean it's something in between those two, I think, because what I'm talking about here is trying to bring about an appreciation of the scale of the horror and of the destruction wrought by the Holocaust. Because I think a lot of our commemorative ceremonies in a way, they're well-meaning, but pass by in some crucial way what we're actually talking about, which is that when the survivors tried to return to their homes, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, which is where the majority of the Holocaust's victims were from, what they found was total devastation, that they were often the only survivors of their families and even of their communities and their towns, and that whole communities were wiped out. One of the things that I think is underappreciated is that of the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust, we still don't even know the names of over 1 million of them. There are whole communities in Eastern Europe about which we know nothing, and which is really extraordinary when you consider the vastness of the documentation and how much has been written. There's still places we know simply know nothing about. That is what I think I mean by trauma, where there are often a handful of people who survive from those places whose lives are completely turned upside down by what had happened. And when you think about the destruction of Jewish culture, particularly Yiddish-speaking culture as a whole in the Holocaust, you get a sense of what I'm talking about, this a whole ancient culture that is effectively wiped out by this process.
Thank you. Can we trace the process by which the Nazis' Jewish policy shifted from one of forced emigration to one of extermination?
Yes, we can. There's both, I think, a simple and a complex answer to this, because this question about the Nazis' decision-making process for the final solution used to be, when I was an undergraduate, for example, absolutely the backbone of the historiography on the Holocaust. But it is, of course, entirely perpetrator-centred, and that has been criticised in the last decade or so, saying, well, actually, not just in the case of the Holocaust, but in any genocide, we need to think about the victims as agents with real lives, not just people to whom bad things happen. So there's been a shift away from that focus, but we can still address that question, and it remains an important one, of course, because if we want to understand how this event happened, we need to think about the perpetrators and what they were thinking. So I think the simple answer is to say that in a series of steps between spring of 1941 and spring of 1942, the Nazis go from a policy of expelling the Jews out of Germany, then planning to expel them out of Europe through successful prosecution of the war, through to a process of killing them on a regional basis, firstly in the general government, i.e. the part of Poland that was occupied by the Germans but not incorporated into the Third Reich, and then expanding that killing policy to the Jews of the whole of Europe. And that itself is preceded by, first of all, the euthanasia program in Germany, and secondly, what's known now as the Holocaust by bullets, the shooting by the Einsatzgruppen and their allies of Jews in the Western Soviet Union. So you can trace these steps. What's difficult is showing exactly who is making the decisions when, because there's competing evidence. There's a lot of different agencies involved in the Third Reich, not just the party on the one hand and the civil service or the Wehrmacht on the other, but within the Nazi party structures, there's a lot of competition going on between Goering and the plenipotentiary for the program for the four-year plan, Goebbels and the propaganda ministry, Alfred Rosenberg and his ministry for the occupied Eastern Territories, Hans Frank in the general government, and in particular, and the ultimate, I think, winners in this process, the SS under Heydrich and Himmler. They're the people who really take control of the process, but not without considerable competition from other Nazi agencies. And you see this in, for example, the administration of the Łódź ghetto, where the SS doesn't quite get its way in the same way as it does elsewhere, because there are other local interests at stake. So I think what I've tried to go into this to some extent in the book and address the evidence that shows when in spring, summer, autumn of 1941, you can see this kind of shift, the role of the Wannsee Conference in this process, etc., etc. But I think the one thing you can certainly say with clarity is that by the spring of 1942, what you can see is that the final solution as a Europe-wide program is in place. There have been a series of steps to get there, but it's by spring of 1942 that what we now think of as the Holocaust is really the program that the Nazis are undertaking.
It's interesting you highlighted the SS and its role there. Are there agencies or actors whose role you think has been misunderstood in this story?
I think there are actors whose role has been underappreciated. So there were plenty of agencies within the SS or the RSHA structure. The main security office headed the umbrella organization run by Heydrich in the first instance. So whether we talk about the RUSHA, the Race and Settlement Main Office, or the so-called Volksdeutsche Mittelstelle, the office that tried to assess the German racial qualities and of people across occupied Central and Eastern Europe, various other SS agencies, the Waffen-SS, and so on. These are all competing for power. And there have now, in, I suppose, the sub-discipline of perpetrator studies, been many attempts to show how these different organizations operated, what they shared amongst themselves, and what differentiated them. And one of the most important groups, I think, and outside of the SS, but within the RSHA umbrella organization, is the Order Police. I mean, since Christopher Browning wrote Ordinary Men, the Order Police have been on the radar of historians as, you know, regular policemen who nevertheless took part in the crimes against the Jews. And some of the recent work, including a study by Ian Rich, shows that, I think this is an important finding, that they were not as ordinary as it quite appears in some respects, in that the leadership stratum of these groups were Nazi ideologues, very clearly. They all went to the same training school in Berlin-Köpenick. They were all of the same generation, just too young to have fought in the First World War, but who felt the effects of the inflation and then the depression, and who were highly ambitious, careerist, and keen to make a career for themselves under Nazism. The men under them were more mixed. They were not necessarily ideologically driven in the same way. But what was crucial, and I think this actually is a finding that is useful for thinking about the Holocaust as such, was not that everybody was a rabid anti-Semite or believed in the worldwide Jewish conspiracy and so on, but that the leaders did. And whether we're talking about the leadership of the Order Police or of the SS or of the Third Reich as a whole, what mattered is that the leadership stratum genuinely believed in this stuff and then had the means to mobilise other people to participate in it.
Thank you, yes. One of the misapprehensions you talk about in the book is the idea that the Holocaust was a mechanised, efficient process. I wondered if you could pinpoint where that sort of misunderstanding has come from and how we should, in fact, see this story.
Thank you. That's an important question. I mean, I think it comes from the end of the war itself. So when the Red Army liberated Majdanek in Lublin in the autumn of 1944, one of the first publications that came out of that process, even before the war had ended, was a pamphlet by Konstantin Simonov, the Russian journalist, called The Death Factory in Lublin. And this idea of the death factory had also been used already by other writers about Auschwitz and Treblinka and so on, but even before the war had ended. So it became a very common trope. And it's not surprising in a sense, because the idea of building a fixed installation where people would be sent to be killed obviously smacks of a kind of factory-like institution or building or camp. And so I'm not surprised by this, but I think the problem is that actually, it's not very pleasant to have to think about this, but the actual process of killing people in either the Reinhard camps, Belzec, Sobibor and Treblinka, or at Auschwitz or Majdanek, was not industrial in the sense that, well, industrial tends to imply efficient, clean, orderly, regular. And actually the killing process, in certainly in the Reinhard camps, was very brutal, violent, extremely messy. Those were places that were not camps in any meaningful sense. Hardly anybody lived there. They were places where the Jews from the general government, i.e. the Jews of Poland, were deported, were stripped and were murdered and then were plundered, had their bodies plundered for gold teeth and so on. The way they were killed was through the use of internal combustion engines with a pipe attached into a room. There's nothing efficient, modern, technologically impressive about it. And of course, the motors broke down. People had to wait, knowing what was happening to them, whilst the engines were fixed. And the general chaos around the process, of course, is something that is often not described, and the impact of the killing process on the surrounding area. So there's been some interesting recent research on the smell of Treblinka to the nearest towns, you know, 5 miles away, people could see in the air and could smell what was happening there. I think we forget about that because it's those, I think, things that relate to the senses are harder for historians to write about because the sources are less obvious. And the same is true even at Auschwitz. I mean, when Auschwitz was working at its height, the killing rate was extremely fast. Nevertheless, it's not sophisticated technology. It's extremely primitive. It's extremely brutal and violent. When you read descriptions written by surviving members of the Sonderkommando and others about what actually happened to people when they were killed in that way, I think the using terms like industrial genocide, it kind of hides from us the truly horrific nature of what was happening.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
These were people who were traumatised, above all lonely, not just in a slightly miserable sense, but deeply, existentially lonely, who now had to pick themselves up, try and get help from international organisations with resettlement or repatriation, learn new languages, learn new skills, meet new people, all the while trying to make sense of what had just happened to them.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We'll talk a bit more about whether or not we have a tendency to look away from some of these aspects a bit later. I wanted to ask you first, to what extent you think the shape of the Holocaust was changed by the shape of the Second World War more generally? Do you think the two things can be traced against each other like that?
Yes, I mean, there is definitely a correlation. First of all, the Nazis can only put their hands on Jews that they have access to. It's a kind of obvious point, but I think it bears repeating. And the best example of that, I suppose, is the fact that the Jews of Hungary, the largest surviving population group in Europe in early 1944, is only rounded up and deported to Auschwitz in the spring of 1944 after Germany occupies Hungary. So before that point, Hungary is allied to the Third Reich, but with a few exceptions, it's an anti-Semitic regime under Admiral Horthy, but he claims not to understand what the Nazis want when Hitler talks about deporting and killing the Jews. So he's willing to go to a certain point, but no further. And that only changes whilst Horthy still is in power, by the way, after the Germans occupy the country in March 1944. And the same is true of Jewish populations elsewhere. If you look at the deportation of the Jews of Amsterdam or the deportation of the Jews of Salonika, Thessaloniki, you see exactly the same process. That it's only when particular countries are occupied that the Jewish population in them is accessible to the Third Reich. And the same is true of the Germans' allies. So Romania, again, is, I think, the best example that Antonescu decides in 1941 when Romania invades the Soviet Union alongside the Wehrmacht, that the Jews of, first of all, Bukovina and Bessarabia will be deported and killed in Transnistria alongside the local Jews, which includes the area between the Dniester and the Bug rivers, which includes Odessa as the largest town. And the Jews there initially, the Romanians want to push them across the Bug into German-occupied Ukraine, and partly because the Germans won't take them, the Romanians then set up kind of makeshift camps and ghettos in Transnistria itself. And that's why some 300,000-350,000 Jews are killed by the Romanians rather than by the Germans in that locality. Nevertheless, by the end of 1942, start of 1943, Antonescu is changing his mind. And it has to do with the war situation. And so the Jews of old Romania, particularly the Jews of Bucharest, and the Jews of the Banat in the west of the country are not deported for various reasons. It's quite complicated. You know, we can deal with them later if you want. But it's quite clear that there's a correlation between the war and the Holocaust. So for the Nazis' allies, they start to see, well, once it starts to become clear that the Germans are not going to win the war, they start to reassess their position on the Holocaust. What is clear to them is going to be a bad look when Germany loses. The same is true in Vichy France, for example. But for the Germans themselves, I think, I mean, your question, I guess, is a response to books like David Cesarani's Final Solution, which placed a great store on the ad hoc nature of the Final Solution and talks about how the deportation of the Jews happened in response to the military situation. I think that's clearly correct in the sense that the Nazis only deport Jews that they can access, which is related to the military situation. But it leaves unexplained the choice of the Jews as the target in the first place. So, yes, there is a correlation between the Holocaust and the war, but focusing on the war doesn't necessarily explain the attack on the Jews by the Nazis. Just one final point. When you think about the deportation of the Jews of the Greek islands at the end of the war, say, there's no military gain to be had in that. And yet the Nazis do it anyway.
One aspect of that story that I knew nothing really about that your book talks about is the rise in slave labour subcamps in the final stages of the war. Can you explain a little bit about what happened there and I suppose also what it tells us about the nature of the Holocaust more generally?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to talk about this because I think there's a kind of strange situation, which is that these subcamps are very often referred to by survivors in their memoirs or oral testimonies when they're given, and yet they haven't really been incorporated into the synthetic histories of the Holocaust. There's something quite strange about that they're sort of present and not present in our understanding at the same time, and yet they remain really very important. And I think that they've been absent partly because they slightly confuse the history of the Holocaust, that we think, okay, if we say that by 1942, as I said earlier, that the Final Solution as a recognisable Europe-wide programme to kill all the Jews of Europe is in place, then how do you suddenly explain in the summer of 1944 the creation of all these new little camps in which Jews are taken from Auschwitz or from the Łódź ghetto or from Hungary and sent to work in them? There's an obvious clash between Nazi ideology there, which is that race trumps labour, and the attenuation of this ideology at this point. But that is what happens. Actually, by the start of 1945, where there are, 13 or 14 main concentration camps in the Third Reich, so you know, Buchenwald and Mauthausen, Flossenbürg and so on, there's about 1,000 of these subcamps attached to the main camps. It's a huge number, and many of them are almost all of them, actually, I think, are places that most people have never heard of. Not very much is known about many of them, and yet they're really very important for understanding the Holocaust. So to come to the second part of your question, first of all, the Nazis set these up, and the SS set them up and kind of rent Jews to local firms who use them, simply because the war economy demands it. The Germans are desperate for labour at this point. All the German men are in the Wehrmacht. German women, who have, of course, to look after their families, are working. There are something like 7 million foreign forced labourers in the Third Reich. So not concentration camp inmates, but people who have been taken from Ukraine or Poland or Yugoslavia or France and dragged into the Third Reich to work in agriculture or in armaments factories and so on. And it's still not enough. So at late in the war, the SS starts to use concentration camp inmates as slave labourers. And I make this distinction between forced and slave labourers where, most forced labourers were also not well looked after, but they were also often housed in camps and so on. But they were not concentration camp inmates in the same way that the slave labourers were, who were totally exploited, were not paid for their work and so on. And the importance for the Holocaust is that These people, it did slightly attenuate Nazi ideology, but only slightly, because all that was happening really was that these people's deaths was being deferred. So the war economy and the SS that used them in this situation basically made the decision, okay, we don't really want to do this, but we're desperate. We'll use these Jews until such point as we don't need them, and then we'll kill them. And the way in which they were treated also, of course, was totally inimical to any meaningful productivity. So on the whole, with exceptions, the slave labor camps were better than Auschwitz in the sense that people had slightly better beds and the food rations were a bit better. Nevertheless, the work was often brutal and people were weakened and then returned to Birkenau to be killed when they were too weak to work anymore. But, and this is very important, the being sent to a slave labor subcamp meant that in the final days of the war, those who'd been in them, and they were generally very young men and women, and actually often boys and girls, aged between 14 and 18, were slightly fitter than they would have been had they simply been sent to Auschwitz or to Gross Rosen. And that is what allowed them in the last days of the war to survive the death marches and the liberation period. So the fact that these camps were created out of desperation, first of all, there's a kind of irony in this, in that suddenly there were large numbers of Jews again on Reich territory, which had been declared Jew-free by the Nazis. But secondly, it also inadvertently allowed many of these Jews to survive. Again, only on a purely contingent basis, all of them would have been killed eventually. And had the war lasted a little longer, many of those who were liberated at Belsen or Dachau or Buchenwald would have been dead. But I think the fact that they'd been in these subcamps was what kept them alive.
As well as sort of tackling the big picture sweep of this story, your book also talks about some obviously understandably moving stories of individual experiences. Are there any stories or individual experiences that you think tell us something about these themes? Perhaps these themes that aren't properly understood, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, there are many, I think, and in different settings and at different moments in time. So one of the, I think, very moving sources from early on in this period is a letter that was written by a German man to his grandson, which was actually never written, but is one of the few examples that we have of somebody really understanding the implication of what was happening in Germany in 1933. So this is a man called Max Meyer. This is in 1938, but it is typical of a few examples of people at this point who could see what the logic of Nazism was. I don't mean that they predicted the Holocaust. There were people who did that, but you get the sense that that was in a sense they were saying things without necessarily knowing exactly what they were talking about. But there are people who understood the apocalyptic nature of Nazism from quite early on. And so this letter says, in fulfillment of this theory, which is dressed up as an ideology, an orgy of racial hatred has been instituted, together with a process whereby Jewish persons are subjected to total and systematic disqualification. The entire party machine, the press, vocational training, broadcasting, official propaganda, the political education of the young, the whole of national life, all have been harnessed to the task of stripping Jews of their good name and social acceptability, regardless of personal standing. They are being ousted from their homes and livelihoods and compelled to emigrate destitute of means, and the belief in their human inferiority is being duly incorporated into the Aryan world of ideas. And I think that, you know, in 1938, that's quite a prescient and trenchant summary of what's happening. So there are those, and I think the fact that he never sent this letter, though it was written to his grandson, is also telling. And there are many such letters of this sort that where you see people trying to work out what's happening. But this one, I think, is particularly clear in its assessment of what is going on. Other, I think, personal tales, I think a lot to jump towards the end of the Holocaust period, I think I focus quite a lot on individual tales from the periods of the death marches and from the subcamps, precisely because, as we were saying about the subcamps, the death marches too haven't been incorporated into the synthetic histories of the Holocaust in quite the way that they should, I think. And some of the tales, in particular, That of Trudy Levy, who became later famous as the author of Cat Called Adolf, and so on. Her story, I think, is really remarkable. It's in some ways typical of the trajectories of those who survived the Holocaust, but on the other hand, extraordinary. And I think that's true of all of these narratives, that they have a lot in common. But there are many where you read them or listen to them and you think that this person should have died then or then or then. And you realize the absolute role of chance in survival. And that, I think, is something that is really extraordinary and also important to talk about, because it goes against this notion that we really want to believe in, that people survive because they really wanted to or because they fought against what was happening to them. And actually, I think almost everybody who survived, of course, wanted to survive, but survived because of luck.
Talking about the end of the war and the end of the Holocaust, one of the interesting things you talk about in your book is how language can sometimes be unhelpful, particularly when it comes to such terms as liberation. Can you talk a bit about why these ideas, why these phrases may actually get in the way of us understanding the true nature of this story?
I think this is because they impose... Even simple terms impose a kind of narrative structure on the way we think that leads us towards an ending and imposes a kind of ending on the story. And that ending tends to suggest that things are over and done with. Doesn't necessarily have to be a happy ending, though that's also implied in many of these terms. But survival, liberation, etc., these are all terms that imply an overcoming of something, that the horror has been finished with, it's been suppressed, and now things can move on. And actually, survival is a very problematic term, because survivors of the Holocaust were, for the most part, people who were very ill, who remained ill psychologically, if not physically, for most of the rest of their lives, and people whose survivorship came to define most of the rest of their lives. I'm not saying that Holocaust survivors didn't go on to lead normal lives. Actually, the psychological studies of them are often surprised by the extent to which they were able to do so. Nevertheless, the memory of what happened to them, of course, never left them. And there's a kind of trauma that was passed down to their children and things that happened to them that I think could never really be fully explained to others, even to other people who were there, so to speak. So survivorship is a problematic concept. Liberation is even worse, I think, because although I continue to use the term because it's hard to think of another, nevertheless, the idea of liberation bringing freedom and relief from suffering, I think, is very much off the mark when it comes to the Holocaust. Actually, those liberated, with exceptions, so the survivors from Western Europe were able to go home, albeit slowly. If you think of Primo Levi's trajectory home after being in Auschwitz, it took something like 9 months and was extremely circuitous, his route back to Turin. But for those Jews from Central and Eastern Europe, what happened to them? They ended up in displaced persons camps in Germany or Austria, a small number in Italy, because they had nowhere else to go. And so this idea of being liberated and free to go where they wanted was absolutely not what happened, and in some cases for many years after the Holocaust. And again, you know, I think to come back to what I was saying before, that these were people who were traumatized, above all lonely, not just in a slightly miserable sense, but deeply existentially lonely, who now had to pick themselves up, try and get help from international organizations with resettlement or repatriation, learn new languages, learn new skills, meet new people, all the while trying to make sense of what had just happened to them. The idea of this as a kind of liberation is slightly mocking, even.
Mm. We touched on earlier the idea of perhaps a looking away from the full extent of the Holocaust and these stories we've talked about. Do you think some of that looking away is because the Holocaust has things to tell us about modern society and post-war society that we're not yet ready to engage with fully?
I do. It's a very big and complicated question. And I think part of the answer to this is that Holocaust commemoration is extremely well-meaning. I think it's probably better that we have some Holocaust education than none at all. It's probably better that we have Holocaust commemoration than not. But the part of the problem here is that these commemorative ceremonies tend to settle into a particular format. They become repetitive and, to some extent, platitudinous. And they follow a similar kind of template every time they occur. And I should emphasize again, I mean, I'm not saying it's not well-meaning or it's cynical. I don't think that's necessarily the case, although sometimes you can see the involvement of certain politicians and so on, where you think, okay, this is a little bit opportunist. On the other hand, to come back to your second part of your question, it's a very difficult question to answer briefly because it touches, I think, on huge philosophical and sociological questions. But yes, I think that part of the problem is that the Holocaust does suggest something about the modern world that is very difficult to take, which is not, it's not that this was a regime led by madmen that has nothing to do with us. I think that's a really bad mistake. The Nazis were maneuvered into power by German elites who wanted to protect their own interests. And when you look around the world today, it doesn't seem so far-fetched to think elites will bring people into power who had previously been unacceptable if they feel that their interests are threatened. The role of the pillars of society, the military, the church, the monarchy or the political establishment, etc., the police and so on, in the Third Reich is, again, an extreme version of what happened elsewhere, everywhere under Nazi occupation. The participation of the Dutch civil service, because that's what they were trained to do, the French railways, the Romanian civil service, etc., etc., the list goes on, suggests that we as modern societies and cultures, can slip into doing terrible things, in a sense, without even realizing it, and that there are the Holocaust was driven by particular passions and obsessions of the Nazi elite, but the participation in the process by virtually the whole of Europe suggests that this isn't something that we can just simply push away and say this was the work of a few madmen. So it's a very complicated and difficult question, but it's one that I think is important to think about.
Thank you. Yes, and do you think similarly that the shape of Holocaust historiography and research has to some extent been hampered or shaped by even an academic unwillingness or a national unwillingness to engage with this kind of thing?
It varies from place to place. I think that the Holocaust historiography, and there's quite a large gulf, I think, between the scholarly landscape and the world of popular representations or popular memory or commemoration of the Holocaust. But to focus on the former for the moment, I think the best scholarship on the Holocaust is now international in scope, international in terms of scholarly cooperation and so on. And there's a lot of very good work being done. Where it's hampered, I think, is on at the national level. So it's certain, obviously in the post-communist countries, but elsewhere, including Greece, for example, and in the UK to some extent, there was a kind of belatedness in grappling with some of these issues for various reasons. And that's slowly changing. But if you compare, let's say, Holocaust historiography in Poland, which is now pretty sophisticated, with that in Romania, which is growing, but you know there's still quite a gulf between them. The Romanian historiography of the Holocaust is hampered by the fact that it's still a country in which talking about this subject is not very popular and won't get you very far. So there are all sorts of problems along those lines. But I think at a purely scholarly level, that it's not really such a problem. The problem is bridging the gap between scholarship and public understanding and doing so when having to take on establishments, for example, obviously the current government in Poland, for example, or other interests that want to push certain understandings of the Holocaust that are less critical than others. The idea, obviously, of talking about the Holocaust as a pan-European crime is not something that plays well in certain countries that don't want to address their own involvement in this. And it also doesn't play well in Germany, where conventional Holocaust pieties, if you like, are very rooted in controlling the idea that this was a German crime, because anything else was somehow waters down the significance of the event to the German ethical landscape and memory landscape. So it has effect in both ways.
What challenges do you think the recent rise in nationalism and national populism poses to the legacy of the Holocaust? And do you think it only adds to the importance of teaching it in the correct way?
It's a huge question. I think that the rise of right-wing populism and nationalism and xenophobia across the world tells us, in the first instance, that teaching kids about the Holocaust at school is not going to be the answer to our problems. I'm not opposed to Holocaust education, but I think we have to be realistic about what can be asked of it. So we can't solve the problems of the world by teaching about the Holocaust and expecting children to then grow up into nice people who care about others. Unfortunately, if the broader socioeconomic conditions are poor, I think Holocaust education will go out the window. And that is what we see at the moment, that I'm sure there are lots of people who voted for populist parties across Europe and in the US and elsewhere who've had Holocaust education, were very moved by what they learned, and who nevertheless voted for populist right-wing parties anyway, because they feel that they speak to their interests at that particular moment in time. So it's not a simple correlation at all. There is some evidence that those who have Holocaust education talk about themselves as being better tooled up, if you like, for dealing with prejudice and xenophobia and so on. But that's self-reporting. And when it actually comes down to it, I'm not sure how much credence we can give that kind of evidence. The problem, I think, here is that, so that's to do with Holocaust education. That's a separate problem, and one that is important, because so much store is placed on Holocaust education that I think we need to step back a bit and say, hang on a minute, this is not the answer to all of these big problems. We're not going to combat xenophobia across the world by teaching about the Holocaust. The bigger problem here, and this is about the rise of the populist right, is that although there are many commentators and academics in political theory and history and so on who say, well, there's a difference between populism and fascism. These are people working within the democratic system and not outside of it or opposed to it and so on, is that I think that one of the ways that the Holocaust did change the world is that there is now a kind of store or a reservoir of aesthetics, of imagery, of vocabulary, simply of feeling that tends towards fascism, and that the solutions offered by Nazism have echoes in those that are being talked about today in radical quarters. So ideas about the great replacement theory, this notion that there's a conspiracy to do away with the white race and replace them with brown people and so on. These sorts of ideas sound familiar to us, and there's a reason for that. And that means that, you know, something has been inserted into our culture that we cannot get rid of, and that that has to be we have to be continually vigilant about it.
That was Dan Stone. The Holocaust, An Unfinished History is out now, published by Pelican Books.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.